And follow along as I read Esther chapter 6. This is God's word. On that night, the king could not sleep. And he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, "Haman is there, standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him come in." So Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and let the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" Then the king said to Haman, "Hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned." So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. And then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." And while they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. Thank you. Please be seated. Well, you know, history is full of stunning reversals, you know, where you think one thing's going to happen and the opposite happens. And one of them happened in the 1580s. You had two major world powers, England and Spain. And England was raiding Spanish commerce, and Queen Elizabeth was supporting Dutch rebels in the Spanish Netherlands. And the King of Spain was not very happy about that, Philip I. So he decided to conquer England. And the Pope of that time, Sixtus V, gave his blessing. He had his own interest in this, hoping that the campaign would bring Protestant England back into the Catholic fold. So on May 19th, 1588, the Invincible Armada left Lisbon to get control of the English Channel and to bring in a Spanish army from Flanders. So they had 130 ships in this fleet, 2,500 guns, 8,000 sailors, and 20,000 soldiers. Now, the Spanish ships were slower, they were less well-armed than the English, but the Spanish were confident that if they actually got engaged in battle, they could board the British ships and they would carry the day. And they had, you know, good reason to think that. Besides the timing of the attack, the English sort of found out about it late in the game. They were scrambling, and it looked like there was an advantage for the Spanish. Well, what turned out to be the Armada's worst nightmare did not come from England. It came from the sky. They were delayed by storms, and they had to turn back to Spain, did not end up reaching the southern coast of England until July 19th, 2 months later. And by that time, guess what? The British were ready. And as they say, the rest is history. And you have all kinds of instances like that throughout history where you think things are going to go a certain way, and something comes out of nowhere and changes everything. And that's what happens here. The story of Esther is a story of what we call God's providence, God's working, his hand. Even though his name is not mentioned, God is everywhere in this book. His fingerprints are everywhere, and he's working behind the scenes to carry out his plan. And I just feel like there is no message more desperately needed at this point in history, in this world, and I would say specifically in this country, you know, for the church. And so you see God's work in Esther all the way through the book, but nowhere is it more obvious than right here in this chapter. So I want you to see, there's an outline, by the way, if you want to follow along. I want you to see, first of all, how God's invisible hand arranges circumstances. Now, I just read the chapter. Now, as I was reading through it, were you hearing things where you said, you know what, there's no way that that could happen by chance? You know, what are the chances of that happening? How many things came to your mind during that passage like that? I think the first time I read through it, I counted like, I don't know, 7 or 8 things. This did not make sense. You know, anybody reading this story could say, well, you know, obviously this is fiction. They just made it up. You know, if you make it up, you can put anything in there. But how many times have we said truth is stranger than fiction? You know, who would have scripted the way the World Series went this year? You know, everybody said Cubs fans, you know, Cubs were favorites. But, you know, if you could have said, yeah, the Cubs are going to win, you're a Cubs fan. Oh, yeah, that's great. But if you tell them, well, you're going to go down 3-1 first, and you have several heart attacks on the way to the win. You know, there were just all kinds of twists and turns, the way they both burned out their pitchers and you know, the way it came down at the end. You know, you just could not. You know a movie's coming out about this. You know, and the Red Sox in 2004, who would have ever scripted the way that happened, going down 3-0 to the Yankees in the ALCS? And then, of course, the most recent example, who would have ever scripted this election a year ago? You know, who would have ever said, okay, this is what's going to happen, and this is how it's going to happen, this is how many candidates. There's no way. There is no way you could have figured that out. Real life provides drama that nobody could dream of. And so I think Esther is one of those cases. And if you don't believe it's true, well, I can't change that, but I'll try to persuade you. So Karen Jobes, one of the commentators on this book, pointed out that the structure in Esther is built on one word. And I never thought about this. It's really fascinating. There's a Hebrew word for feast or banquet. And she says that the whole book is built around this word. Not just the word, but the idea. So that word feast shows up 24 times in the whole Old Testament, besides Esther. 38 books, 24 times. You know how many times it shows up in Esther? 20. In this small little book, that word shows up 20 times. And it's not just the number of times, but the key to understanding how this book goes. And if you're a literature person, the rise and fall, you know, of the action, where the climax is, where, you know, where the pivot point is, all of that is determined based on this idea of the feast. So Karen Jobes has found a pattern of feasts in the book, and it's in a shape, it's in a chiasm. So chiasm is just a tool, like it's patterned after the Greek letter chi or x, and it's just like a mirror. You know, you start out here and you work in, and everything is sort of reflected in this pattern. So she sees two feasts at the beginning of the book. If you know, some of this we covered, some we haven't. At the beginning of the book, there are two feasts that Xerxes has: one with his nobles, one with the people in Susa. Well, at the end of the book, you have two feasts, sort of in an identical pattern. These are when the Jews are victorious, establishing the Feast of Purim. So you get two and two, beginning and ending. Well, then a little bit in from the beginning, you have Esther's feast when she becomes queen. And then a little bit from the end, you have Mordecai's feast. Well, right smack dab in the middle of the book, you have two feasts, right? And those are Esther's two feasts with Haman and the king. And here's the thing. There's this great moment of tension that's coming. I know I'm sort of giving some of it away, but you're okay with that. In the next chapter, there's going to be this big tension where Esther's going to confront Haman, okay? I'm not going to give it all away, just part of it. So Esther's going to confront Haman, and that's a huge moment in the book. And you would think, okay, that must be, that's the climax. That's the big moment of action. But when you look at the pattern that the author himself or herself laid out, that's not the center of the book. You know where the center of the book is? Right here in chapter 6. In fact, it's the first verse of chapter 6. That night the king couldn't sleep. It's right between these two feasts. Now, why in the world would that be the center of the book? Makes no sense. Well, literally, the original says, "And that night sleep was taken from the king." Does that put it in a little different light? Now, as far as we know, the king wasn't sick. He wasn't even bothered by the fact that the Jews were going to be annihilated very soon, which is not, you know, not good. He should have been, but he wasn't. So he just couldn't sleep, couldn't explain it, just, you know, wide awake, staring at the ceiling. So what's a king to do? Well, Xerxes had a lot of entertainment options available to him. You know, he had all kinds of food, drink. He probably had dancers that he could snap his fingers and they would just, you know, come out and entertain him. He could, you know, he could have anything he wanted to distract him. But on this night, he chose to have the chronicles of his kingdom read to him. This was the official record of the Persian kings. Really exciting reading. You know, sort of like reading the minutes of your last staff meeting at work. You know, that would be just really exciting. It might actually help you get to sleep if you needed to, so not a bad idea. So maybe that's why he does it. So he has, this is the record of his kingdom. As the servant is reading through what's happened in his kingdom, he comes across the record of Mordecai foiling a plot to take the king's life 5 years before. So in all that time, in 5 years, nothing had been done to thank Mordecai. And, you know, this is sort of a side, but, you know, just think about Mordecai. He does this huge thing. Nobody even acknowledges it. He just keeps doing his thing. He just keeps serving the king at the gate day in, day out. Says a lot about him, doesn't it? And this was unusual. Kings usually were very good about rewarding people who saved their life for obvious reasons. You know, you want your life to be perpetuated if you're the king. So be good to the people who help you. But somehow this one fell through the cracks. So Xerxes is determined he's going to do something about it. And true to form, he never did anything without consulting his band of seven men. These were the men that were around him that he consulted with. And so, you know, but here's the problem. Who's going to be in the court at 3, 4, 5 in the morning? Well, guess what? One of them just happens to be there at that very time. Haman, who's so eager to hang Mordecai because it so bothers him. Whenever he goes by Mordecai, Mordecai will not honor him. So Haman is so eager to hang Mordecai on this gallows, he's shown up before the crack of dawn, and he wants to get this detail taken out of the way so that he can enjoy the rest of his day, you know, and he can go to the feast with Esther and the king. So he's standing there in the court, and the king calls him in. In ancient cultures, which is the time period during which this was written, people tended to view history as sort of a battleground between the gods. You know, you have the storm god and the drought god, and whichever one is more powerful, that's where you get rain, or you don't get rain. You know, circumstances are worked out in the battle between these gods. And so fate and circumstances, it was never a sure thing, because nobody knew which god was going to win at any given moment. But you see, this book shows us a god who is in control of the circumstances, even though he's not named. He actually determines what's going to happen. Now, I was just thinking about how this happened in my life. I want you to think about how the way that you became a Christian. What circumstances went into that? What things happened in that process that you look back on and you say, boy, you know, it really doesn't make sense that this happened. You know, you ever have something like that? So here's one for me. I'll give you an example. Maybe that'll prompt you. I became a Christian at a camp in North Carolina when I was 14 years old. And the interesting thing was our church youth group was having a contest. So we had these books and we had points and you had, you know, games and things. And so they had this running contest for the whole year. And the winning team got to take this trip to this Christian camp in the summer. And I had no interest in going to this Christian camp. I really didn't have any desire for God, even though I had grown up in the church. So, you know, we go through the whole year and lo and behold, guess whose team wins? So I guess I didn't feel strong enough to just tell my parents, no, I'm not going. So I ended up going. And that was where I became a Christian. And it's one of those things that, okay, it seems like kind of a random thing, you know, wow. Why would that happen that way? Have you had things in your life that you look back on? Like, you know, there was one conversation you had with one person or one phone call or one, you know, a book you picked up or a trip you took or something. And you think, you know what? If my life had taken one turn to the right, that would never have happened. So much of our lives come down to very small, what's seemingly insignificant circumstances. And yet, God is in control of those. Isn't it amazing, on one side, how he arranges those circumstances, but isn't it amazing, on the other side, how worked up we get about our circumstances when they're not going the way we think that they should? I mean, many people are convinced that this election on Tuesday will either save or doom our nation. And you know, both sides, it all depends which candidate you're for, based on one person in power. But as Christians, of all people, haven't we learned differently? Haven't we learned from this book that God holds the heart of the king in his hands, or the heart of the president, or the heart of the senator, or the alderman, or whoever? And so I want to encourage you on that point. Take that confidence into the booth with you on Tuesday. And I won't talk about it anymore because it's, you know, on Tuesday. Thank goodness. The second thing I want you to see here is that God's invisible hand exposes pride. So he arranges circumstances. He also exposes pride. Haman arrived in the court, probably, I'm guessing, a little bit surprised to be summoned so soon by the king. He probably figured he had to wait a few hours. The king, in his eagerness to take care of this issue, invites Haman in, but he doesn't ask Haman what he wants. That's what I think is so amazing. You would expect the king to say, "Oh, Haman, you're here. What do you want?" No, he's too concerned about this. He doesn't ask Haman what he wants. He launches immediately into his question for Haman. Now, what's really surprising is that Xerxes asks his question about, you know, how do I reward this person, without naming the person. And, you know, it's ironic. You have a lot of irony in the book of Esther. Just as Haman left out the identity of the Jews when he said to the king, I think there's a group of people we should get rid of. He doesn't mention who they are. Well, you know, in the same way, Xerxes here says, hey, there's a person we should honor. But he doesn't mention that this person is a Jew, or specifically that it's Mordecai. So he simply says, what should be done to the king, to the man whom the king delights to honor? Now, you remember the last couple of weeks, we've talked about Haman's idolatry. Haman, what was Haman's greatest love? It was attention. It was honor. He was addicted to honor. He loved to have people talk about him. And so Haman immediately forgot everything that he was intending to do about Mordecai and figured that he had really hit the jackpot. And certainly the king wanted to honor him, but he just didn't want to embarrass Haman. I mean, if that were actually possible to embarrass Haman, I don't know. But he didn't want to embarrass Haman by using his name, and so he just, you know, referred anonymously to this person. And so Haman's overinflated pride just takes over. And he uses this phrase, if you look at it, he uses this phrase, whom the king delights to honor, four times. Once to himself, and then three times in his answer to the king. And he's just dreaming of all the adulation that he's going to have. Now, Haman already has a lot of possessions. He doesn't really need more stuff. He already has the highest position in the kingdom besides the king. So what does he ask for? Well, he asks for the next best thing, and that is identification with the king. You see, many ancients believed that the king's possessions carried magical powers. If you wore the king's robe, it somehow gave you, you know, some kind of power, some identification with him. And so that's what he asked for. The king's robe, the king's horse with the king's crest on it. And he wants to be paraded in the busiest part of the city. Guess why? That's where all the people are. That's where he'll get maximum attention. And so you think, okay, a modern equivalent would be having a ticker tape parade thrown for you and riding in Air Force One. You know, that's sort of the closest equivalent I can come up with. You know, you have the prestige and the dignity of the office of the president when you ride in that airplane. So this is what he describes for the king. And the king says, great idea. But then he shatters Haman's world when he says, great, you do all that for Mordecai. the very man who Haman was committed to ending his life 5 minutes ago, now Haman has to honor with all of the accolades that he thought he deserved. Oh, the inhumanity. But, it's obvious when we look at it that Haman got trapped by his overinflated pride. There's an example in the New Testament of a similar kind of reversal, where what you think is going to happen totally turns itself around. In Acts chapter 5, we're at the beginning of the history of the early church, the very beginning, and the early chapters of Acts, it tells us how the church lived, what it was like. And they worshiped together, they went to the temple together, they met in their homes, they ate together, they shared their possessions. Whenever somebody had a need, somebody else came along and helped them out. And so in Acts 4, Barnabas, one of the leaders in the church, or one of the members of the church, sold a field and gave the money to the apostles and said, whatever needs there are, go take care of them. And, I'm sure that people thanked him for it and he got some attention for that. So Ananias and Sapphira were this couple in the church who were very much like Haman. They loved honor. They loved for people to praise them. They loved public attention. And so they didn't really care about helping anybody out, but they really wanted people to thank them and to praise them. So they sold property too. They took a portion of the money, brought it to the apostles and said, "We love God so much that we brought this, we sold this land, and we've given all this money to you so that you can distribute it." And so Peter separately asks Ananias and Sapphira, the man and his wife, "Okay, did you sell it for this much?" He gives them the amount that they gave. And he said, "Is this all the money?" And both of them separately say, "Yes." And immediately, in both cases, they're struck dead. Now, you might say, "Well, okay, that seems kind of harsh." Peter didn't do it. But God himself, in that circumstance, chose to act in that way, because the integrity of the church depended on rooting out deception. And what happened with Ananias and Sapphira was they had this incredible desire for honor at others' expense, and it ended up doing them in. All right, last thing I want you to see here is how God's invisible hand rewards evil. That's sort of a segue into this last part. So Haman, things have really gone badly all of a sudden for him. He leaves Mordecai on this parade route that was supposedly reserved for him. And the whole time he's calling out, "This is what's done for the man whom the king delights to honor." Sort of like, here's a guy who did a great thing for a king. This is a good idea. You should do a good thing for the king. And so the words that seemed so sweet in his mouth when he was thinking about people saying them about him are not so sweet when he's having to say them about Mordecai. So afterwards, the text tells us, Mordecai returned to the king's gate. Again, it's so striking. Mordecai gets all this attention. He gets paraded around the city. And what does he do after? He just goes back to work. He goes back to the same place that he's been for 5 years when nobody paid attention to him at all. Doesn't make any difference. It really didn't change Mordecai. It says a lot about him, again. How much of my state of mind depends on what people think of me? It's a good question to ask. That's how we can tell how driven we are by the approval of others. Haman, on the other hand, was devastated. He covers his head in shame, runs home to lick his wounds, and really, in essence, he was mourning. His reaction to being humiliated publicly was the same reaction the Jews had to a death sentence. And it's kind of the way he looked at it. To be shamed publicly was like a death. That was how terrible it was. Now, what Haman didn't realize was that was sort of a foreshadowing of something a lot worse that was coming. So he got home, told his wife and friends what had happened. And last time they gave him advice, he said, "What am I to do? I don't like when I see Haman, when I see Mordecai, it bothers me." And they said, "Well, just build a gallows and have him hanged, no problem." So this time they have advice for him again. But notice their advice has changed now. And the other thing is, last time it was his wife and his friends. Notice who he has now advising him. They're wise men. Now, I don't know if Haman's friends all of a sudden became wise or if he had hired some people in the last couple of days, you know, hired some wise men. I don't really know. But this is the first time that the word wise men is used. So they say to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is Jewish, you will not overcome him, but you will surely fall before him. Now, why did they say that? How do they know anything about the Jews? My hunch here is that Haman had not actually told them that he had targeted the Jews. He had not told anybody, but this was sort of his plan that he was hatching. And when they find out that Mordecai's a Jew and that this is everything that Haman was going to do, they remind Haman, this may be a problem. They use the phrase, the seed of the Jews. And that had some significance for them, and it should have had for Haman. You see, Haman, a few hours before, had everything going for him, and within another few hours, he will be dead. And how did all of this change? Well, these friends of Haman nail the cause. Haman had messed with the wrong nation. You see, God had said to Abraham in Genesis 12:3, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And that blessing really had two parts. It was land and family. Now, by the time of the Exodus, Abraham's family had, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. So that part had already gotten fulfilled. The only part was the land, and God was about to give them the land. They came out of Egypt and were on the way into the promised land. But as I shared a few weeks ago, the first people that got in the way were Haman's ancestors. The you could call them the Amalekites or the Agagites, but they were Haman's family. And they attacked Israel as Israel was passing through the wilderness. And that was when God put his special curse on them and said, this people will ultimately be wiped out. And so Haman's curse on the Jews was about to come back on his own head. Now, we have a lot of there's a lot of interest in our society with the idea of karma. And this seems to kind of match up with that idea. Okay, well, Haman, he started something bad, and now that bad thing is coming back on him. But you see, the difference between karma and providence is that there is a person involved. Karma is sort of a nebulous force. Providence is directed by a good and loving God who has attributes that the Bible describes. His holiness is justice. It's very, very different. And that's what we have here. So God, who is not named in this story, is very, very active. He will not allow evil to go unpunished forever. Sometimes he waits a long time. But even in here, even though he was fulfilling words from hundreds of years before in Haman's life, he was doing it through Haman's actions. And so God's justice, we learn, it's not random, it's not capricious, it is just. Since this is the election season, I thought I'd share this. In June of 1972, five men broke into the Democratic Party's headquarters in the Watergate Hotel in Washington, D.C. And sort of small, insignificant burglary ended up being a much larger scandal and became really the biggest scandal, some would say, in the history of our country. It led to the imprisonment of a number of White House employees and led to President Nixon's resignation about a year and a half later. One of the amazing things that I find about the story of Watergate is that my understanding of the election, the burglary happened in June. The election was in November. The election was never even close. Nixon won in a landslide. And the scandal did not break open until after he was in office. And so you had some news about it. It was sort of a little simmering here and there. But he didn't need that. He didn't need to carry that. He didn't need the information they got. It didn't actually help him. But, you know, what is striking is the president and these other men's incredible arrogance and determination to win at all costs, regardless of what happened. Yeah, to anybody else in the process. And it ended up costing him the very thing that he wanted the most, which was the position of the presidency. But what I find striking about that story, most of all, is that the entire operation might have gone off without a hitch, except for one guy. And his name was Frank Wills. He was a security guard at the hotel. And he was just walking down the hall doing his rounds, and he saw duct tape on a lock of a door. And he thought, that's kind of strange. Maybe that shouldn't be there. So he took it off and kept going. Didn't even investigate. He comes back around, and he sees duct tape again on the same lock. And so he's like, okay, maybe I should do something about this. So he calls the police, and that's when they arrest the burglars. So had they, you know, had they used their heads and just not put the duct tape back on there, found some other way, nobody might have, you know, ever found out. But again, you know, what have we learned in Esther? So many huge events in history come down to very, very small, seemingly insignificant circumstances. And that piece of duct tape led to this process that ended up changing a nation. And so the other thing we learn is that God is not blind to injustice. So I want to wrap it up here. But here's the scary thing. What do we see in Ananias and Sapphira and in Haman? We see this incredible pride and arrogance. But here's the scary thing. We have the same root of that pride in us, don't we? We have that pride deep down in our hearts. How do we keep that pride from destroying us and from the people we love? Do we just need to keep it in check? You know, do we just need to hope that it doesn't get out of control? I mean, is that really the best that we can do? You see, the reality is we can't. I mean, how many times have you found your pride getting you in trouble? How many times have you found that your pride, you know, maybe it didn't put you in prison, but maybe it harmed or destroyed a relationship? You know, maybe it didn't cost you your life, but it might have cost you your job, or it might have cost you, you know, something along the way. It might have alienated you from your family. There's all kinds of things that our pride does to us. So where is the hope here? Well, in the whole story of Watergate, what I find as the glimmer of hope was a man named Chuck Colson, who I'm sure most of you have heard of. He was one of the men in Nixon's administration who was at the center of the cover-up of the break-in. They called him the Hatchet Man, and he was held in awe for his willingness to do just about anything to get what he wanted, you know, just about anything to get what Nixon wanted. He was ruthless. And so Chuck Colson did go to prison for what he did, and while he was in prison, it was there that he really got confronted with his pride and his arrogance, and he realized he couldn't fix himself. God had to change his heart, and that was where he became a Christian, and he tells the story in his book, Born Again. And I look at Chuck Colson, who just died, I think, a year or two ago, and I get hope for Hamans of all kinds. Because you know what? There's a little of Haman in every one of us. We have the same roots of everything that he did, even if it doesn't show itself the same way. But you see, the good news is that God can change us from the inside out, and that's the only way he does it. And in this culture where there's so much animosity between people of different views, I think, to me, it's comforting that when you think about it, if you're a Christian here today, at one time you were God's enemy, weren't you? And aren't you glad that he didn't just destroy you? You know, he didn't just get you out of the way. What does he do? What did he do with you as his enemy? He changed your heart and he made you into his child. That's the beauty of the gospel. That's the hope that we have in Christ. That's pretty good. Father in heaven, I thank you that we can look at this passage and realize that you really are in sovereign control of every event in our lives, and not just in our lives, but in our nation, in the world. You're not sleeping at the wheel. And I pray that you would remind us of that today, this week, and remind us of that in all kinds of other circumstances. When we look at what's going on in our lives and we say, no, this can't happen. This is not what I wanted. This is not what I signed up for. Lord, help us by your grace, by your Holy Spirit, to submit to your plans for our lives, even when we don't understand them. And that's we need your peace, Lord, in the midst of the storms that we're suffering. And so please, Lord, help us. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.